Very good. Excellent. So it's 4 minutes past eight now, and one of the first things on hindrances I'm going to talk about is patience. Hopefully, those 4 minutes. What were you thinking? Were you thinking anything? Or were you doing what the most important part of patience is, just enjoying the space between moments? I mentioned this before, but it's a very useful technique. Sometimes we're very busy, we feel we have no time, but we waste a lot of time. It may be you're waiting at a traffic stop or at a junction and the light is red. What do you feel? Do you start thinking, when's that light going to go to green? Or do you think, oh, what a wonderful opportunity, it's red, I can relax a little bit and just take your feet off the accelerator, hands off the wheel, and just stretch out and just think, oh, what a wonderful opportunity, I've got a pause between all of the problems of you have to face when you're driving. At least when the light is red, you know the benefits of being caught at a stoplight. It means that you're not going to get caught for speeding. You're not driving. You can answer your telephone, can't you, if it's a red traffic light? Is that illegal? You're not driving, are you? Okay, so there's many advantages when stopped at a red traffic light. You can talk to the other people in your car, give them some attention, get a glass of water and other stuff. But of course, you know, you don't drink alcohol. That's what happened to one of the Thai disciples years ago. You know, she went into a police traffic stop and they said, we're going to test your alcohol level. Have you been drinking? She said, yes. And then they took her breathalyzer and it was zero. I said, you're zero. You said you've been drinking. Yeah, I've been drinking orange juice and water. She wasn't being cheeky. She'd just come to Australia and her command of English wasn't that great. Those are the things which happen. So nevertheless, when you do have these moments, you have these two types of waiting. And the two types of waiting are, number one, waiting for something to happen. And number two is waiting in the moment. And of those two types of waiting, the waiting for something to happen causes more stress and more hindrances. It's a kind of restlessness. You're not really in this moment. You're off into the future sometimes, waiting for something to happen. And that's never peaceful. And the second type of waiting, waiting in this moment, it's just a nice opportunity to take a rest. You're sitting down, it's comfortable in here, it's warm now, you sit down and relax to the max. That's called waiting in the moment. So of course, I came 4 minutes late. I would say on purpose, but I keep my precepts as well. I was late and caught up with somebody outside. But nevertheless, always remember about waiting. Waiting in this moment. And when you get into some nice meditations, and you think, wow, it's about to happen, it's about to happen, it's about to happen, please don't wait in the future and think, when's it going to happen, when's it going to happen, I'm close, I'm close. Always wait in this moment. Where you are now, be content with that, satisfied with that. This is good enough for me, this is wonderful. I'm getting peaceful. Don't think that where you haven't reached yet, think of where you have reached. A lot of times that's the trouble with human beings. They always think that what they haven't got, rather than appreciating what they have got. I've got some peace. I haven't got a microphone now, it's fallen off. So be patient. But the main thing I was going to talk about this morning, as I promised yesterday, was about sloth and torpor. That's one of the second hindrances. And sometimes people, they're meditating, and they just don't know why, but they tend to fall asleep. A lot of times that is because of trying to control the meditation, working hard. Sometimes you feel, how many days have gone past already? Three or four? Three. 3 days. How many are left? Only 6 days left? 5 days left? Oh my goodness. Are you getting anywhere yet? Oh my goodness, are you embarrassed? Are you ashamed? Are you going to ask for your money back? I should always tell you that on these retreats you can ask for your money back. I always promise that. It's Buddhist. We're not into sort of being wealthy. So if it's not working for you, you can always ask for your money back. Guaranteed. You won't get it back. But you are allowed to ask. Anyway, back to sloth and torpor. That was one of the problems I had when I was a young monk. Really bad sloth and torpor. And it was hard to overcome that sloth and torpor. We had all these little tricks we thought would help. One of those tricks I haven't got the... I think you don't have these matchboxes these days, but one of the things we used to do as monks, because when we were meditating, we thought, I was really peaceful. And then, it's peaceful for you, but you couldn't hear yourself snoring during the meditation because you were really sleepy. So in order to make sure you had some mindfulness, you were really sleepy, you take a matchbox full of matches, take the cover off and just have the tray full of matches, and you put it on top of your head. And the reason you did that, because if you started nodding, the matchbox will fall off and go all over the floor. And you'd hear that very easily. But it was amazing just how well that worked. After only about 2 or 3 days, you put the matchbox on top of the head, and for the whole meditation, it never fell off. It never fell off. And then one of the monks took me aside and said, "Oh, we figured out why it doesn't fall off. In the old days, when you would nod, you nod like this." I said, "I'll watch you nodding, and you would nod like this." And it's true, your mind is really sneaky. So you tried all other things to try and keep yourself awake, but nothing tended to work. And then what happened, I was volunteering to do many services for the other monks, and one was to go down into Bangkok to do the visas. So I remember this time I went down to Bangkok, and the overnight train should have been really tired. That was, sitting up all night. And then when you got down to Bangkok, there was a new accommodation block for monks built in this very good monastery. And so we had permission to use that accommodation block, and it had fly screens on the windows. So there wasn't any mosquitoes to keep you awake at night. And we also had a nice place to sleep, had nice mattresses, instead of sleeping on a grass mat on the floor, which is what I used to do in the northeast of Thailand as a young monk. You could have a good night's sleep. We didn't have to get up early in the morning for morning chanting at 3 a.m. We could sleep in and get up at 4. People say, that's early enough. And when we went on alms round, we got decent food. Now, honestly, the food which we got in the northeast, it not only didn't it taste nice, it had very little nutrition. Even the rice was not nutritious, the sticky rice. And the reason was because in the northeast it was very sandy soil. So in the monsoon time, any sort of goodness in the top part of the soil got sort of washed down. And so it was very, very... bad nutrition in the soil. And so when we ate what came out of the soil, that was also bad nutritionally. And I was thin. I was malnourished. But you went down to Bangkok, you got decent food there. And so you had much more energy. And you had a good night's sleep. You weren't woken up by mosquitoes all throughout the night. And then in the morning, one of the monks, they found out that on the same floor where our bedrooms were, there was a room there where they would give seminars with an air con. And so we got the key for that, and at 4 o'clock in the morning, we'd go there, turn on the air con, and meditate for a couple of hours. It was cool. I had a good night's sleep. I was properly nourished. I had some energy in my tummy and in my bloodstream. And then it was amazing. There's no sloth and torpor at all. You could sit there and had some very nice meditations. Every morning I was down there. And you realize that one of the major reasons for sloth and torpor were physical. It wasn't I was a weak monk. It was the fact that I didn't have any energy to be really awake. I was not sleeping enough. I was, again, malnourished, and it was really hot in Bangkok. Now, I was born in UK. It's cold there. You don't need air conditioners. You need sort of heaters all the time. And so I was not used to the climate. And I sometimes, a bit irreverent, but I thought, you know, if any of these great arahats in the time of the Buddha, if they came from England and went to practice under the Buddha in India, they too would have sloth and torpor. It was very hot for them. And so once those things were dealt with, sloth and torpor vanished. And that was kind of strange for me, because I always thought that sloth and torpor was some sort of spiritual problem. There is some spiritual side of sloth and torpor, but mostly it's physical. And one of those problems physically is not being able to sleep enough. You come on these retreats and you see that, look at the schedule, you're supposed to get up at 4 o'clock or 4:30 and be in the hall at 5 o'clock. At home, how many of you get up at 5 o'clock in the morning or 4 o'clock in the morning? Weirdos. I say weirdo in a very nice way, simply because most people in the world don't get up at that time. And so you're changing your sleep habits, and are you sleeping well? And also you come here with sleep deficit. It's one of the reasons why you ask your body what it needs, and if it needs a rest, give it a rest. Take it to bed and say, have a nice sleep, me. And then after a while, you feel you've had enough sleep and your body wakes up. One of the other things I find is a cause for sloth and torpor, the temperature. Are you comfortable this morning in this hall with the aircon on? Not me. Unfortunately, as a monk, I can't take my robes off. But if I was in my room at this temperature, I would. You know, that's what I used to do in Thailand. You know, just have the lower robe on, anything else was just took all those robes off. And then, but what happened there, that because it was in a jungle, you had all these animals that you shared your hut with, including, and this is again no exaggeration, tarantulas, big spiders. And during the hot weather, they would, I don't know why they did this, but they kept falling from the roof onto your body, and they'd run across your body. I wasn't scared, because maybe I was sensually deprived. I found it very sort of ticklish when a tarantula would run across your body. It was very pleasant. It never stung me or bit me or anything, but it was just like an interesting feeling, as long as you didn't, you know, remember what their name was. So this is just how we dealt, you know, with some of the environmental difficulties which you had. And you do find out what is the cause for your sloth and torpor if you are sleepy. Don't just think, I've got sloth and torpor, it's my personal mistake. A lot of time it's because you're tired, you're sick, you know, you are, the climate is not quite right for you, you didn't sleep well last night, you didn't have the right type of food or whatever. Check out the physical causes first of all, because you'll be surprised, 90% of the causes for sloth and torpor are physical. And once you get that all sorted out, I'm fortunate, I do have an aircon in my room in the teacher's cottage. Nuns, you have aircons too, don't you? Yeah. So this is discrimination. So if you want an aircon, all you need to do is ordain. I don't have one in my cave. But nevertheless, that a lot of times I like going up there to meditate, just get the temperature just right, what I know is good for me. And you can sit down, you don't have to worry about the noise of other people. You can relax, rest, have water there, whatever you need. And it makes it much easier to meditate, for me anyway. So if you tried all those physical things, and you know, you tick them off, that's not causing it, it's nice temperature for you, getting enough food to eat, not too much, not too little, and yet the climate is good, you've had enough rest, then of course the physical causes have been dealt with. So then you can start to see the mental causes, the emotional causes. And this is where the sloth and torpor cause and the restlessness cause tend to coincide. And a lot of times it is we get sleepy because we have not enough interest in the meditation. Or we have a negative state of mind, or aches and pains or whatever. What that means is we look for a place to escape to. And one of the places to escape to, of course, is the dreamland of sloth and torpor. You're not really aware, you can fantasize. One of the things with fantasies, because you're kind of in control of the fantasies, you always end up being the winner. I remember doing this once. It wasn't really a fantasy, but it was like just the starting off of nimittas, and it was a complicated nimitta. I was very aware, and in this nimitta, I could see that there was a Hindu holy man, and it was me. And we had this battle in the psychic plane, flying through the air, zapping it. It was really fun. I wasn't dreaming. I was as a nimitta, and I just enjoyed it, zapping each other, blah, 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 blah. But I knew I was going to win. You know why I would win? Because it was my nimitta. I was in control. Really good fun. So sometimes you have complicated nimittas. I know many teachers would say, if you have a complicated nimitta like that, just let it go and disturb it. It's not disturbing, it was fun. And to me, you know, when you're meditating all the time, sometimes it just gave you a little bit of R&R. There's something different. I knew it wouldn't last, I knew what was happening, so I didn't mind it that much. I just had fun and enjoying it. But nevertheless, that I know that if you just start to get involved in something like that, think, do, that also causes too much doing. That is tires out the mental part of your energy by doing too much thinking. Yeah, you kind of get awake and alive, but it's still just wasting time. One of the monks I know, he's quite a famous monk now, it's not me, but he was staying with this monk who was a really, really good monk. He did have some psychic powers. And they would usually meditate for 2 hours every morning before they went on alms round. And every time, 2 hours in the morning, sometimes you've had a good sleep, sometimes you feel good, sometimes you can meditate well. But a lot of times it was just hard work. Sometimes you get up in the morning and think, I should really still be in bed. But of course, the discipline of those monasteries meant you couldn't. So it was always a struggle usually for him to keep, you know, awake during the meditation session for 2 hours. And so one morning he decided, this is just too hard work. He decided to have a fantasy. And he said, when you have a sexual fantasy, 2 hours went past so quickly and he didn't have any sloth and torpor at all. But then when the meditation had finished and the bell went, and he thought, oh my goodness, what have I been doing? I hope the teacher hasn't been looking at my mind. He had fear. And then the teacher came up to him. Didn't usually walk straight up to one monk, came right up to him, looked him in the eye. You know what he said to him? You've just been wasting your time. It was like in between being a criticism and also being some kind advice. So instead of, but he found out they had no sloth and torpor when he was thinking fantasies. But it's a waste of time. So if you ever have sloth and torpor, don't go off to your favorite fantasy. Yeah, you won't have sloth and torpor, you look like dead straight. But you're wasting time. What does he really mean by that? It means that if you're with the sloth and torpor, it means your brain is tired, your mind is tired. Your body may have had a good sleep, but if your brain is tired, it needs to re-energize. And thinking fantasies or whatever, or plans, that doesn't re-energize your mind. That actually draws more energy from it. And even the Buddha said that. He said to the monks and the nuns, if you start thinking sexual fantasies and stuff, one of the problems would be, it feels okay, but you're borrowing energy and you have to pay it back afterwards. You get more tiredness afterwards. The best thing to do is just to be with the tiredness and be mindful of the feeling of sloth and torpor. What does it feel like? And that's eventually what I started doing. Instead of fighting the sloth and torpor, you were there, you were tired. Fine. Be mindful of it as best you possibly can. The mindfulness was not strong. It was not interesting, just watching tiredness or a bit of dullness, but you could still see something there. The trick was I wasn't trying to get rid of it. I wasn't trying to find the breath or find the feelings in the body. Just this was right in front of me, this tiredness, this sloth, this drowsiness. And after a while, you can become an expert on drowsiness. There's many people write books about nimittas and jhanas. There's very few meditation teachers write books on drowsiness. But it can be really interesting to actually to notice, what does it feel like? Where do you feel it? What happens to it? Does it stay the same? Does it get worse? Does it get better? What causes the drowsiness to increase? What causes the drowsiness to disappear? And this, of all times, you can understand just by experience. When you don't do anything, when you don't fight a war with drowsiness, when you just get to know it, understand it, leave it alone and allow the energy which you have. It's like your body is always making some energy and giving some energy to the brain, but if you keep on using that energy just to fight the lack of energy, it never actually increases anymore. But if you just allow the drowsiness to be, you notice that the drowsiness gets less and less and less. And usually what happened, you know, I mentioned this in another context yesterday, sometimes, you know, you're meditating, your head is down, but you don't fight it. You just know, what does this feel like? And you care for it, you don't try and cure it. And then what happens? You can tend to notice your back starts to straighten up and the head lifts up. All by itself, the energy of your mind, when it's not wasted, goes back into your awareness. And your awareness gets brighter and brighter and brighter until your awareness is back to a state where you can scan your body, you can watch the breath, you can get into nimittas as a natural progression. You don't fight. Trouble is when people have sloth and torpor, they take that as a personal failing. It's nothing to do with you. It's just the state of your brain because you've been thinking too much or doing too much, and try and cure that by doing more or struggling with this or that. That doesn't work. Instead, just be with the tiredness. Get to know it. Be a friend to it. And if you're a friend to it, it disappears. Because before, when I was fighting my sloth and torpor, I don't want to be tired. You know, you just straighten up and use willpower. And all this doing, use willpower. And sometimes you break through the sloth and torpor through willpower. And then you were restless. You couldn't stop thinking. And then you calm the mind down. Okay, no, don't think too much. Relax, rest. And then you're back down on the floor again. And it was because you were using energy and you were wasting energy. But the way of just being tired, having that sloth and torpor, it was the letting go and just allowing the energy to come back into the mind, and it would actually cure itself. You'd have the energy back and you become straight and you weren't restless afterwards. Before I was like swinging between restlessness, sloth and torpor, sloth and torpor and restlessness. You couldn't find that middle way where you had energy but you weren't restless, you weren't thinking too much. And that's actually how you solve that problem. And I was really inspired in one of the suttas, often like telling the story, the Buddha was with his attendant Ananda, and they went into a forest. On the edge of the forest they saw one monk who was meditating there, sitting in a perfect posture, you know, right foot over the left foot, right hand over the left hand, thumb slightly touching, back straight, chin down, eyes closed, just watching his breath. Perfect posture. And the Buddha looked at Ananda and said, I'm worried about him. A couple of weeks later, that monk disrobed. He went further into the forest. There was another monk in the middle of the forest, head down, sloth and torpor, and the Buddha smiled at Ananda and said, I'm not worried about that monk. And of course, when I saw that, I thought, there's something wrong there, some mistranslation. Surely, the monk with the perfect posture, that should be the inspiring one. And the Buddha said, no. That monk, even though he has sloth and torpor, he was in the middle of the forest, you know, far away from people and things, and he wasn't so attached to, you know, gaining fame or possessions. And he knew that, yeah, he was sleepy now, but that sloth and torpor will soon disappear by itself. You know, when it does disappear, that monk in the middle of the forest, he will just have this incredible peace of deep meditation and be able to see the Dhamma. And of course, the Buddha was right, became fully enlightened, that monk. There's so many monks I've known who have sloth and torpor. And you think after a while they've just become great monks, great nuns too. Why? It's because they weren't control freaks. They knew how to let go. They just had to wait until the energy came back into their mind. To be with these natural phenomena. Don't own them, don't possess them, don't identify with them. Let them be. And then the sloth and torpor disappears all by itself. It's a wonderful thing in this path of meditation to notice just how much you don't have to do, how much this is an automatic process. And the more you get involved, the more problems you make. It's one of the reasons why this particular insight, piece of Dhamma, I got this not from any sutta, not from any words of a great meditation teacher. I got this when I was flying from one place to another in Air Asia flights and just picking up the in-flight magazine and reading this article, which was written by one of the captains. And he was saying, the aircraft of the future. And he said, in the aircraft of the future, you won't have the sort of cabin crew or the in the flight deck, which you have these days. In the future, he said, you'd only have two beings in the cockpit. Those two beings would be the pilot and the dog. That's all there would be in the cockpit of your plane. And he said, the only job of the pilot, not to touch anything on the control panel, the only job would be all automatic, much safer. The only job of the pilot was to feed the dog. That's what he needed to do. And the only job of the dog, the reason why the dog was there, was to bite the pilot if he tried to touch something. He said that would be the aircraft of the future. And I thought about that. Wouldn't it be wonderful if I could somehow insert a dog into your mind? So when you were meditating, if you tried to do something, bite you, so you could actually learn how to sit there and do nothing. What could be easier than that? You'd think it should be the easiest thing in the world. But the ego comes up and says, no, I can't let other people see me sloth and torpor and tired. I know there's once over in one of these all-night sits we did in Thailand, This one man, a visitor, he had a camera. He took photographs of the monks when they're sitting, you know, overnight. When one of the monks knew he had been photographed and he was a very sleepy monk, he grabbed that camera and exposed all the photographs. He was like embarrassed about being sleepy. I remember many times I thought, if I can just sit there being peaceful, and even if I'm sleepy, and not be embarrassed about it, not take personal ownership of it, I think that's wonderful. And of course, you still manage to do that. You're sleepy anyway, but I wasn't sleepy, it was just cause and effect. I left it alone. And then also you could relax much more. And then you'd always notice the body start to straighten up by itself as your awareness started to grow. And you became far, far more deep in your meditation. So anyway, that's the sloth and torpor thing. Now, the reason why we have sloth and torpor, I say it's some physical thing, it's too hot, or it's just not enough food that day, or too much food, or you didn't sleep well, or some sickness in your body. Get to know it. Get to understand it. Be aware of it and get insight into the causes of sloth and torpor. Once you know the causes, you know the solutions. And it's all, they have these, what they call hindrances, but they're all sort of interrelated somewhere. If you think too much, you're too restless, and you get sloth and torpor. If you fight sloth and torpor, you get restless. But why are you fighting it anyway? It is because of the first two hindrances of wanting, desire, and also ill will. We don't want to have sloth and torpor. You have a beautiful nimittas, one meditation, sloth and torpor the next. Why can't I have nimittas all the time? Why can't every meditation be good and beautiful? You may have had one good meditation already on this retreat, and you think, oh, now I know how to do it, and the next meditation is terrible. Why? And that is explained by the story, which is also a joke, but it's a good story. It's not a joke just to make you laugh. It actually tells you a lot about what meditation is, and that was of the refugee who came to Australia. When this refugee arrived in Australia, in his homeland, he was a highly qualified doctor. But those qualifications weren't recognized in Australia. It's the same. Australia's really strange that even in psychiatry, one of the psychiatrists here in Perth had told me they invited this one of the leading psychiatrists, you know, from the United States to come and teach here. And when he arrived here, it was so well known that they still had to check his qualifications. And they say, well, those are qualifications only apply for US. We have to give you a test to make sure that those qualifications are usable in Australia. And they handed him two books. Please have a look through these, study these, and we'll give you a test in a month's time, and that will qualify you to practice psychiatry here in Australia. And so this guy took those two books, and the first one they gave him, he said, whose name is on this book? Who wrote it? That's me, he said. You mean you're going to test me on the book that I wrote? And he also said, oh, it's embarrassing, but yes, we have to. Fortunately, he passed. But anyway, this was a refugee, and he wasn't well known in Australia. So they couldn't give him a job as a doctor, so he took whatever job he could find, which was on a building site. So he was fit and healthy, he would do anything to feed his family. So he went to the building site, worked really hard all day. When he came home at night, his wife asked him, how much did you earn today? He said, nothing. They didn't give me a cent, nothing. He went there the next day, same thing happened. Worked really hard, you know, on the building site, still didn't earn anything. Wednesday the same, didn't earn anything. And he really thought of giving up. These people in Australia, they just exploit migrants and refugees, to take advantage of them. So he didn't want to go to work on Thursday, but his wife sent him anyway. He went there, and same thing happened, no money. And then he had nothing else to do. He went to work on Friday as well. He never worked that hard on Friday. What's the point of working when you don't get paid? But then in the middle of the morning, the boss asked him to come in the office and gave him this big pay packet. Lots of money in it. When he went home that day, he was very happy, and he told his wife, I finally figured out how it works in Australia. From now on, I'm only going to go to work on Friday. I'm only going to meditate when I get nice results on payday. But you actually remember that all of those wonderful meditations you have, which you have, they're natural, it's nothing to do with you. A lot of them are caused by all the other meditations you've done where you didn't get a paycheck. You're accumulating that peace, that wisdom, those insights, which allow you to get into deep meditation. So you can't expect every meditation to be payday. Well, you can expect that even if you've meditated many, many times, if some meditations are just doing the work, you're not getting paid yet. But then, you know, the more times you do meditate, the more the credit is being built up, the more the credit is being built up. And when your payday comes, it's a really big wad of bliss and insights. That's how this meditation works. So, the wanting, that's actually what stops any progress in the meditation. Everything else you've done in your life, you got success when you strived, you worked hard, you wanted it to happen. Over here, wanting, it just takes you out of the present moment. You're off in the future sometimes. And as I've said many times, and some of these one-liners, they just are so profound. When you want something more, you cannot enjoy what you already have. I love that saying. Because sometimes, you know, I'm meditating and you've got a delightful breath, really beautiful. And sometimes you're stupid and say, I'm on a nimitta now. I know the nimitta's close. The nimitta's much better than a delightful breath. So I want it. And what happens? In the delightful breath disappears. So wanting, it makes the mind sort of tight. It makes the mind sort of unable to appreciate where it already is. It makes it go somewhere else when the next stage is going to open up right here. Instead of looking at this lotus, which is already many petals have opened, we go and look at another lotus. So this is one of the reasons why when you want anything, you stop the meditation happening. So a lot of times, if I am meditating, and you can see the progress of the meditation, it's getting nice and peaceful. If it is not progressing, sometimes I pause and ask myself, what do you want? When I see anything as a response to that question, I realize, no, that's the problem. I stop wanting. This is good enough. I'm content, easily satisfied. Even those words, good enough. I praise the Ahipasaka group over in Indonesia because they use that as the theme for my recent tour of Indonesia. They like giving the talks and the retreats titles. And the title which they gave it was Cukup Bagus, which is, do you know Bahasa? It's the best way of saying good enough. Cukup Bagus. Did I pronounce that right? Yes, oh, that's very kind of you. It was, I pronounced it Cukup Bagus, good enough. When it's that good enough, it means you can enjoy this moment. Yeah, of course it could be better. Yeah, it could be really blissful, but this is where you are right now and be content with it. When you're content with it, you're here. You stay here. And then you can actually go deeper. We have many extra things we do with mindfulness. I've already mentioned kindfulness. But kindfulness also includes what I have called unconditional mindfulness. You're aware of whatever's happening, without giving it any conditions, indiscriminate awareness, if you like. So it's right here, right now, and you're aware of it. That unconditional acceptance, is another word for unconditional loving kindness. The way my father said it, based on what my father said, the door of my heart is open to you, whatever's happening right now, unconditionally, no matter what you are, whether you're painful, whether you're what I expect, whether you don't expect, the door of my heart's open to this moment, unconditionally. That's another word for letting go. That's another word for unconditional loving kindness. That's another word for the power to make peace, to overcome wanting. And of course, the other half of wanting is the ill will. And the ill will isn't wanting things not to be here, wanting something else. Whatever you're experiencing, please, if you possibly can, have unconditional awareness to it. If it's something which is painful, unpleasant, it's something kind of, I always imagine it as something I have to learn, something I have to face up to. Yeah, it's unpleasant. But I always remember some of the teachers I had at school, the unpleasant ones, the ones I didn't like, were often the ones I learned the most from. And some of the experiences I've had in life, some of the things also which were unpleasant, you know, you wouldn't give them away for the world. You learn so much from those. Now, the times when you were really sick, the times when you thought you might even die, now, the times you were really so disappointed, now, the times, I had my life as a monk all planned out. I found this monastery over here in Perth, and I was the second monk. This other monk, Ajahn Jacaro, he was the senior. That was perfect. Because a senior monk is like the senior car in the convoy. They are the ones which get all the bugs on the windscreen. So I thought, being number two monk, yes, the best. So look, I'm Manisara. Please look after Ayahasapanya, okay? Make sure she lives long, otherwise you get all the stuff which she's having to get right now. And so I had it all planned out. So there I was, and he was young, and not really young, but he was healthy enough. And then what did he do? He disrobed. What did he do that for? That was not in my plans. So now I had to take all the bugs on the windscreen. And there's plenty of bugs being a senior monk. So anyway, that's where whatever you expect, it doesn't happen. Something else does. Yeah, it was just more difficulties, less rest. But nevertheless, you faced up to it and did the best you possibly could. But I'm still here. I'm still trying to give bad talks, because I always thought if I give a series of bad talks and really bad jokes, then eventually the people will have enough of me and say, okay, Ajahn Brahm, off you go. And send me off to a nice hermitage. That's what they do to old horses, apparently. They just go off to grazing. And they don't have to do any work anymore. Is that a good place for me? Send me off to graze somewhere. Can I? I think my jokes are not bad enough. I have to get a worse joke. Okay, here comes one. Here we go. So this is not discriminatory against any part of society or any animals or whatever. But there was once this bear. Was it a bear? Yeah, a bear and a rabbit. And the bear would always chase the rabbit through the forest and always made lots and lots of noise. And one day the bear chased the rabbit past the lake where a magic duck lived. And the magic duck shouted out at both of them, "Mr. Bear, Mr. Rabbit, you make too much noise. This is supposed to be a forest and I like peace and quiet. Will you please, be quiet?" And Mr. Bear and Mr. Rabbit said, "This is just what we do. We've got nothing else to do." And then Mr. Duck, the magic duck, said, "Look, if you promise never to chase each other ever again, I will give you 3 wishes each, whatever you wish for." And Mr. Bear looked at Mr. Rabbit, Mr. Rabbit looked at Bear, and they nodded in agreement. And Mr. Bear said, "Well, my wish my wish, the only reason I'm chasing this, you know, silly rabbit, is because, you know, I'm a male, and it's too hard to find a partner in this forest. So my wish, Mr. Rabbit, no, not Mr. Rabbit, Mr. Magic Duck, can all the bears in the forest be female, and I'm the only male? And so the magic duck said, okay, quack. And straight away, all the bears in the forest were all female, and he was the only male. He could be too tired to chase the duck anymore. So anyway, you know what bears are like. And so they asked the rabbit, what's your first wish? And the rabbit said, my first wish is for a motorbike helmet with two holes in the edge to put my ears through. What do you want that for? Look, you didn't... I don't have to say why. You never ask Mr. Bear why he wants all the bears to be female. It's my wish. And so the duck went quack, and a big motorbike helmet appeared on top of the rabbit's head, you know, with a hole in the back for the two ears to come out. And then, okay, Mr. Bear, what's your second wish? And Mr. Bear said, well, for my second wish, I've just been thinking, it's not just the bears in this forest. What about the bears in the country, in neighbouring regions? When they found out there's only female bears here, they'll all migrate up here. So my second wish, may all the bears in the whole country be female. And I'm the only male bear. Okay. Quack. And that's what happened. Only female bears in the whole country. And then Mr. Duck, what's your... No, not Mr. Mr. Rabbit, what's your second wish? And Mr. Rabbit said, for my second wish, I would like a Harley Davidson 1000cc all filled up to go with my motorbike helmet. I can understand that, said the duck, so quack. And this big new Harley Davidson 1000cc bike appeared, and the duck went on top of it and started revving it up. Oh, he felt so cool. Mr. Rabbit. Okay, Mr. Bear, what is your third wish? You know what's coming, don't you? Mr. Bear's third wish, he said, for my third wish, I'd wish not just all the bears in the country, because there's bears overseas. When they hear, they'll find a way to, you know, to come to this land and spoil all my fun, say, may all the bears in the whole world be female. I'm the only male bear. Okay, said the magic duck, quack. And all the bears in the whole planet Earth were all female. He was the only male. He felt so sort of happy with himself. But he didn't know the punchline yet, because Mr. Rabbit was on his bike with his helmet on, revving up. What's your third wish, Mr. Rabbit? And Mr. Rabbit said, at last he could get some revenge. He's revving up and almost ready to make a quick getaway. My third wish is that Mr. Bear is gay. Vroom, and he was off. That's nothing to do with LGBTQIA+, or with animal welfare. It's just a funny story, that's all. So anyway, hopefully when I tell stories like that, eventually that you'll sue me or something, send me to jail or whatever. Anyway, what was I doing? I was talking about the 500s, that's right. So, a lot of times, what do you want? Sometimes, I used to do that as a monk. You know, when as a young monk, sometimes you see other monks disrobe. And then you'd ask yourself, Ajahn Brahm, would you ever like to disrobe? What would you want? And every time I thought like that, you know, you went, what do I want? And I think I maybe have been alive long enough now to see whatever that is. It's not worth it. A partner in life to love? I've got all of you, which I care for. Not just one person, but many people. Why just fall in love with one when you can fall in love with many? Oh, actually, I should mention this to you as a bit of a warning, that you know those stupas we got outside? They are, you know, from the Borobudur stone. When we opened this place up, one of the monks over in Indonesia, Venerable Sri Panyawaro, offered these to us. He said, these are the same stone as, you know, the Borobudur stupa in the middle of Java. And he said, what size would you want them? And I think in England they had some which was, I think, 110% size. And so I said, well, you know, just to be humble, I'll have 108%, because 108 is a good number. So it's about 8% taller than the real ones. But we assembled them, and they said there is like a myth. Call it superstition, I'm not sure. But the myth, the superstition is, if you can get onto that platform where the stupas are, you can see the beautiful Buddha statues inside. If you can push your hand inside between those holes, and if you can touch the Buddha, then you will find true love. And I will be watching you. Especially those of you with partners already, or monks, nuns, anagarikas. You'll find true love. So you can ask, Ajahn Brahm, have you ever touched the stupa inside? Did I find true love? Yes. The love of the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. In other words, another type of like emotional purity. Instead of one person, many people. So this is why, when we understand what wanting is, when we love things like Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha, we have the unconditional love, not just to one person, but to all beings, yourself included. It's not wanting anymore. So what's the opposite of wanting? Is it like boredom, depression? No, it's compassion. Where the energy of sharing, of giving, is not just to one person or to two people, it's to all beings. That's far more fulfilling and beautiful than just the love to one or two beings, or beings of your family members. To all beings. It doesn't matter just of this religion or another religion, this gender, LGBTQI+, to all beings, even animals as well. Sometimes you can see the birds, and they're so cute. And when you know you have that kind of compassion to them, they will never harm you or hurt you. There are many snakes over in Thailand, even over here. I remember one of the snakes which I encountered over in Bodhinyana Monastery. I've only ever seen it once, but apparently it's still there somewhere, but just keeps a low profile. It was a dugite. And this dugite is very dangerous. This was the biggest dugite I've ever seen. It was 2.8 metres long. I knew it was 2.8 metres long because it was a hot day, and all it really wanted was a shade. So it actually laid next to the brick wall of one of the huts, which was shaded from the hot sun. And also it had been shaded a while, so the bricks were actually cool, so that the snake could actually enjoy the cool sort of next to the bricks. And when it came, I was warned about its approach, because all the kangaroos were running away. The kangaroos were scared of it. And anyway, it came. I was just washing my bowl when I was on a retreat. A personal retreat. I was washing my bowl, and this snake came right up to me, had a look at me. I just carried on washing my bowl and so wished it well. And when I sort of turned around to look the next time, a minute later, it was next to the brick wall. And it had its head in the opposite direction, and its tail was pointed to me. It was just made itself so vulnerable. It trusted me. There's no way in the world I would hurt it. And he realised there's no way in the world that snake would hurt me either. I was washing my bowl and it was using the shade of my hut as a little refuge for a few minutes. And you kind of felt how it must be being a snake like that. Everyone was afraid of it. And the fact that you could just lay there, I wasn't going to try and shoo it away, was actually a bit of a nice rest for that snake. Imagine all these animals. Every time a snake like that appears, they are venomous or very dangerous. People are afraid of them. And that makes them tense up, which means that sometimes they strike or the human being just chases it away and all it wants is a bit of shade, a bit of a rest, a bit of kindness. That's one of the reasons why that kindness which you can develop could do huge amounts of things for your safety and well-being. Anyway, it's 9 o'clock now, but I did start come late, so I finished a bit late. So those are the little words for the sloth and torpor and for the, what's the other one? Sloth and torpor and wanting and ill will. There's another one called out, but... Okay. The one about doubt, the Buddha always said it's like being lost in a jungle or lost in a desert with no ways of finding your way out. And I always remembered that story about the man who was lost in the desert, been lost in the desert for days, ran out of water and was actually struggling on his hands and knees, crawling on the sand, thinking he was certainly going to die. And as he was getting close to death, he looked at the horizon and saw something shimmering on the horizon and thought, is this someone coming to rescue me? And the more he looked, the more it looked like it was something moving towards him. And then he thought, this is like a mirage. It must be a mirage. It was very hot and he was very close to passing out. But as he kept looking at it, he could see it begin to take shape. It was a real thing. It wasn't a mirage. And it came even closer to him. And it was the most weird thing he could see. He said, this doesn't belong in a desert. It was a dog sled. You know, four dogs in front, four huskies and a sled behind. And this guy who was driving this sled was dressed in furs. Dressed in furs in the middle of the desert. It really looked like an indigenous, like what they used to call Eskimos, Inuit people, driving a dog sled in the desert. And then he thought, this is really crazy, but, you know, he thought he was passing out anyway. But then the dog started barking, and they came so close to him, they started licking him. He realised this was real, it's not a mirage after all. And then he sort of got a burst of energy and said, oh, thank you, you've saved me. He said, I've been lost in the desert for days. And the driver of the sled and said, you think you're lost? Okay, that's enough. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Sorry, I can't resist stupid jokes.
Okay, interview.